Welcome to For the Health of It, starring Dr. Jennifer Kretzinger, wellness chiropractor. She is joined by her co-host Jessica and producer Mike Clark. They will inspire you to eat, move, sleep, think, and live better.
Welcome back. Today is a very special episode. I've been recognizing a need in the community and certainly in our practice. More and more people are coming in being newly diagnosed with Lyme's disease, or I'll suspect, given their symptoms, that they need to be tested. And oftentimes people have negative tests and are continuing to have chronic Lyme and don't know. So what we'd like to do today is bring to you a Lyme disease expert and maybe help with some of the fear associated with not understanding the disease. So I'm excited to have Dr. Margaret Miklas in the house. She is a naturopathic physician. She practices in New Hampshire, and she is a graduate of the Kripalu School of Ayurveda, and she's currently on faculty at Kripalu. She completed a physician's training program through the International Lyme and Associated Disease Society. She knows her stuff. Dr. Miklas is a Lyme disease specialist, and her clinical approach is enriched with an indelible respect for Ayurvedic and integrative medicine. What we find is that when we can work with someone who understands the whole body and can look at a disease from a more holistic perspective, it really seems like a person has a chance of regaining health. So welcome, Dr. Miklas. I'm so glad you're here.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
I had Dr. Miklas in the office a few months ago on a health forum. And we allowed the patients to come in. We had a medical doctor, a nutritionist. We had Dr. Miklas, and we had a massage therapist. And we let people just ask any question they wanted. And as soon as the topic of Lyme disease came up, it was clear that that's what people wanted to know more about. So I made a commitment to have more workshops and radio shows dedicated to this topic. So thank you for being here.
You're welcome.
Let's start off with some really, really basic information. One thing you said to me a few minutes ago when we were getting ready was that it wasn't necessarily your choice that you've become a Lyme expert. Explain that to us.
Okay. Well, it really sort of fell into my lap. I would say, you know, in medical school, when you study about this particular illness and infectious disease in general, there is a limited scope that's really brought to your attention. And, you know, obviously that it's a vector-borne illness, you know, that it's a bacterial infection. But really when I started to learn about Lyme was after I had graduated from medical school at the National College of Natural Medicine in Portland, Oregon. And I worked postdoctoral with another doc called Satya Ambrose, who'd been treating a lot of Lyme in Damascus, Oregon. And she was one of the first people that said to me, that she felt that a lot of her MS patients actually were Lyme patients. In fact, she was doing a lot of testing, a lot of antibody testing, and finding that these folks, in fact, did have Lyme. And she had really gotten excited about this in the sense that it was obviously provocative for her, and that she had drawn this correlation within her clinical practice. And really, she was, at that point, one of the first people that emphatically said, I really think that MS could be Lyme. And as a curious post-grad doc, that, you know, fell on, you know, my shoulders, and I said, huh, wow, this is really interesting. When you really look at this differential diagnosis, it seems really clear that there's a lot of correlation, at least from a symptom standpoint. So I came back to New Hampshire, and I started digging around. And I called the... I became interested in vector-borne illness. So,
which, you know, means it, through the air, through
so
flying.
No, a vector is there's a organism that's involved. So a vector is you know, like a mosquito or a tick or a flea. So there's, you know, a organism involved, an insect involved that has a blood meal and from a host. And so it, in regards to Lyme being a vector, you know, the Ixodes scapularis, the deer tick that we know of, is the vector in, you know, the United States. There are other vectors. But I became interested in vector-borne illness as a whole. So what that means is there's other infections that are involved with acquiring a bite from a tick So not just Lyme, and we're maybe getting a little bit ahead here, but I became interested in all of the vector-borne illnesses, particularly in regards to the deer tick.
Well, I think that's important because one thing I've seen is when people get diagnosed with Lyme, oftentimes they have what you call co-infections, which are referring to what you're saying. Okay.
So when I came back to the state of New Hampshire, I was curious about Lyme, but I was also really curious about Babesia. And Babesia, particularly Babesia microti and Duncani, are two species that we see in the United States. And the reason that I bring this up was because I had contacted the State Department of Health in New Hampshire, and there were only two cases reported in 2005 of babesiosis. And I had been really doing a lot of research on this in reference to Lyme disease. And so when I started actually doing testing, I was finding a lot more cases and reporting a lot more cases. So I started to have an experience and realizing how underdiagnosed, you know, not just Babesia, but Lyme. We now know this. It's very obvious that, you know, the Center for Disease Control, you know, openly, you know, reports that, you know, this is an underreported disease.
How prevalent do you think it is in, I can say, New Hampshire, just since you have the experience here?
Well, I think it's a really hard question because, you know, there's how we evaluate that is, you know, Lyme is a clinical diagnosis. So, of course, you know, there's no gold standard for testing. So you can do lots of testing and somebody, you know, can be positive for Lyme and have a negative test. And so this is where it becomes really tricky. I think it's extremely prevalent in New Hampshire. You know, they've done a lot of sampling of the ticks. They know that, you know, I think between 70 to 80% of the deer ticks in southern New Hampshire and thereabouts, you know, in I would say crossing over into the northern parts of the state where they might not have done all the sampling as of now. But they're finding that, you know, there's a really high incidence within the particular deer ticks that they're testing. And so, you know, in my opinion, let's just say for one second here that if 50% of the ticks have Lyme disease and you get bit by two ticks, that gives you a really good understanding as to what your likelihood of acquiring this illness is. Now, that's not the only thing involved in it. It's not just about getting a tick bite because certainly not everybody that gets bit by a tick is going to acquire Lyme disease, but a lot do. And, you know, part of the issue is that one of the signs that most people are aware of as far as, you know, having a diagnosis from at least from a dermatological standpoint is the bullseye rash, the erythema migrans. Mm-hmm. And I can tell you that that is, you know, not as prevalent as they think. And I speak from my clinical practice because, you know, this is my truth, my clinical practices. I can tell you last year, I maybe saw one bullseye rash. This year, I've seen quite a few more, but I diagnosed many cases of Lyme. One of the things that I would say about Lyme is that, and I like telling my patients this, I like telling people in the community this, that the bullseye rash is actually the most atypical presentation from a dermatological standpoint in regards to Lyme, and that any other rash, any other atypical rash is actually more prevalent in regards to Lyme disease.
Okay.
And so there's a myth there. Mm-hmm. Right? We think the EM rash. Now, the EM rash is pathognomonic. You see the EM rash, brilliant. It's there. It's the big pink elephant in the room. Thank goodness. That gives us a good sign, but it's not always there. And in fact, I would say 1% to 3% of the cases, the clinical cases in my office, present with an EM rash.
Dr. Miklas, I read somewhere that 60% of people with Lyme disease have not even been diagnosed. Would you agree with that?
I would actually, not only would I agree with that, but I would say under other circumstances that it's potentially higher. I can say that a very common scenario in my clinical practice is that somebody comes in, they weren't even actually coming in because they think that they have Lyme disease.
Right.
And then when you go through a Lyme checklist, which I do with almost everybody that comes in my practice, because I've had so many surprises where I wasn't, you know, the person's coming in for one issue. And then the next thing you know, I'm like, this is a bit curious. What's your exposure? Where have you lived? And even if that's not, you know, something that it seems really clear, like they've been exposed to ticks or they've lived, you know, in a tick-borne, you know, area that their whole life, I still will test, and I'm often surprised at what I find.
Wow.
So I think it could be higher.
Why do some people get it and some people don't?
It's really interesting. I think that's multifaceted, and really, you know, has to do with immune. I think it has to do with the bacterial load. I think it has to do with, you know, maybe potentially the species of the spirochete. Yeah. You know, is it a highly vascularized area? Is the body able to deal with it? You know, what was the person's health at the beginning of the exposure? So it's you know, multifaceted and multifactorial.
Sure. I mean, anyone that works outside, I work out in my yard all the time. I must have been bit by a dare tick at one time.
So I think, like, when we're talking about just being in southern New Hampshire and the New Hampshire woods, and, you know, the Northeast, like, you look at the maps, you know, of, you know, tick-borne illness in the United States, and this is obviously a very concentrated area. And so, you know, you're at risk. We're all at risk.
I know a lot of people that have it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think what's interesting that I'm hearing, though, is just to put the concept out there, though, that you have some control to some extent with how your body would deal with a Lyme-infested tick. And it's possible that your body could deal effectively, you're saying, and not develop Lyme disease.
Absolutely. I think, you know, well, you and I can agree on this. So the body's pretty amazing and our immune system's pretty amazing. And so, you know, one of the top things that I tell people in regards to Lyme disease prevention is to make sure your immune system is healthy. Make sure you're healthy. Because the one of the unique characteristics of this spirochetal illness is that it is a great mimicker of disease. So oftentimes you hear somebody in clinical practice, and I hope I get an opportunity to share some cases, you hear somebody that said, oh, well, I had this ankle injury that is bad sprain. It happened 20 years ago and I acquired Lyme and boom, this is where it settles. Or I had a thyroid issue and maybe it was hypofunctioning and all of a sudden there's antibodies that are, you know, responding against the thyroid. So it's the great mimicker of disease. And I really feel, you know, it's hard to really measure this from a evidence-based medicine, but I feel, you know, from my clinical practice, what I see is that if there is some underlying weakness, the Lyme will find it.
That makes
sense. So in my opinion, Lyme could almost be any diagnosis. That's why when you actually look at differential diagnoses like MS or rheumatoid arthritis or lupus or anything at all, hypothyroidism, this is a top, you know, comorbidity that I see in my clinical practice, top, hypothyroidism with Lyme. It's really about where you started. And so if you can continue, again, prevention is the best cure. If you can continue to keep yourself healthy, in my opinion, this is one of the best ways to prevent acquiring this illness.
I agree. I've seen a correlation with people with gluten sensitivity that's undiagnosed that seem to be more susceptible to Lyme.
Absolutely.
Well.
And again, you know, in thinking back to some of the ways that we were taught medicine in regards to looking at the GI tract and how much of a role our gastrointestinal tract plays
with immunity. Yeah.
Right. We can't, you know, forget these things. This is, you know, I would say the top priority to really evaluate. And oftentimes you do see people, you know, with Lyme disease that have some myriad of gastrointestinal illness, in my opinion, in my clinical experience, particularly with the pediatrics.
Mm-hmm. That makes sense.
Dr. McGillis, you talk about deer ticks and Lyme disease, but what about mosquitoes or sexual transmission? What are your thoughts on that?
So she's decided to go to the meat of the matter right off the bat. Right?
Okay, so the question really is, how can you acquire Lyme? What are all the ways you can acquire Lyme?
So this is a really hot topic. And I would say what I can tell you is what I know, that they've isolated the bacteria in other vectors. So like mosquitoes, spiders, fleas, I can tell you in my clinical practice, because that's what keeps me out of trouble. I've had multiple patients that have come in and said, oh, I clearly had a spider bite and it ended up in Lyme. Or my dog had this incredible flea infested time in the summer, and I got bit by several fleas and now I have a Lyme diagnosis. So again, in thinking back to, all right, well, what is a vector-borne illness? So if you have a vector feeding on a host that has the spirochete, it takes in a blood meal and then it goes to land on somebody else and have another blood meal, empties the contents of its gut into that host,
right.
Does that seem reasonable? In my opinion, it does seem reasonable. They're not necessarily, I don't know if this is happening now with studies on other vectors, probably in other parts of the country. They're looking at, you know, things like mosquitoes and fleas, but I can tell you that they have isolated the bacteria. I can also tell you that they've isolated the bacteria in every bodily fluid. So breast milk, amniotic fluid, semen, vaginal secretions, saliva. And so again, when you really start to understand and look at what is a spirochete, oftentimes, you know, Lyme Borrelia is likened to the treponema palladium, which is the syphilis. They are distant cousins. They are related. They are both spirochetes. And they have similar features to their illness. And so we know that syphilis is, obviously a sexually transmitted disease. And I think it was Joe Buriscano who said in Under Our Skin that if there was ever to be a time that Lyme was to be considered a sexually transmitted disease, that this would change the landscape of infectious disease forever. And I agree. So it's a spirochete. So as somebody, I've done a lot of, emphasis in my education on microbiology and understanding infections. And when you look at the characteristics of this particular bacteria, it makes sense that there would be a potential. So can I say that I have patients that have necessarily, contracted Lyme disease through sexual contact? I can't make that claim. Right. But it is interesting that they've isolated the bacteria in this way. And it is interesting that there's characteristics that are similar to another spirochete that we do know, can be sexually transmitted.
Well, and I can say clinically, I have many families where one contracts it, has a diagnosis, and so all family members are tested, and 3 out of 4 say we'll have the disease.
And you can also think about pets not only bringing the ticks in, but I wonder about, what if your cat bit you or scratched you, or what is that exposing you to as well?
Well, I think it's a valid theory, and I think in regards to really evaluating something that, this is really epidemic here. Yeah. And so why is it so epidemic? Is it just, we have a lot of ticks, right? We just have so many ticks here. So, but is that all there is? Is there something else that is a concern?
But we can't be afraid to, we can't get off the planet, They're no. here.
Well, this is, so what, this, we is can't. This is what I think we can do now. I'd like to take a break. And when we come back, I want to specifically talk about other than keeping in the best general health we can, what can we specifically do to help prevent ticks? And then a tick is found, what's the next step? What do we do?
You're listening to some raw talk about full potential living for the health of it. Your host is Dr. Jennifer Kretzinger, wellness chiropractor at Spinal Corrective Center in Amherst, New Hampshire. For more information about Dr. Jennifer or this podcast, check out spinalcorrectivecenter.com. If you would like to schedule a health checkup with Dr. Jennifer, call 603-673-5600 and mention this podcast to receive a special offer. That's 603-673-5600. To find a wellness chiropractor in your area, go to chiropractic.org/doctorfinder. Now, back to some raw talk about full potential living for the health of it.
And we're back. We are pleased to have Dr. Margaret Miklas in the studio with us. She is a naturopathic physician. Her practice is actually called Living Natural. It's in Nashua, New Hampshire. You can find her on the website, www.livingnaturalinc.com. We are talking about Lyme's disease. And what I'd like to go to at this point is, I have 2 young children. Obviously, we live in a wooded area. They go to school in a wooded area. What are the best things that can be done to help prevent tick bites other than keeping in general good health?
So it's an interesting question. And I think on some level, you aren't going to be able to prevent tick bites. And so what to do next? But I think really one of the things to think about with children is they are really at a higher risk. Part of it has to do with they do play outside more than we do. But they're also closer to the ground. And so, and they also have their, you know, body is highly, obviously we're all highly vascularized, but their skin is thinner than ours. And so in thinking about, you know, how can we really, you know, be cautious and doing tick checks, absolutely. And it's sort of funny, but I have a child myself and, you know, every night, you know, she's in the same environment. So every night, you know, we are really, she's, you know, taking her clothes off and we're really looking and looking in some of the areas that you might not think behind the ears, in the scalp. I just had a client who was diagnosed, a young little two-year-old who was diagnosed with Lyme. She had an incredible rash, but it went all the way up the back of her neck and into the, you know, the back of the occiput, onto the top of the scalp, very hard to see. And so, you know, not just looking with your eye, you know, scanning, but having them lift up their arms, looking in those areas between the toes, really doing, you know, a very good tick check, I would say. Some of the other things to consider, obviously, people, you know, talk a lot about insect repellent. Some of the things with like the DEETs and things like this are, you know, more controversial because they're a little more toxic. I've actually used neem quite a bit. I don't know if
yes,
you know.
I've heard of that.
Nimba. Mm-hmm. Nimba is the Sanskrit term. It's the tree of 40 diseases in India. And it has an incredibly broad spectrum antimicrobial efficacy. And so I would say using something, whether it's a natural or otherwise, tucking your pants. And I mean, in the summer, it's a little more difficult. They say wearing white clothing, staying out of tall grasses, being aware when you're in the tick areas. Some people are finding, you know, there's certain things they can do, like guinea hens, you know, they say really mm-hmm. love to eat the ticks, keeping the tick population down. Some people spray their yard. There is a product, it's by a company, I think Theraneem, and it's a neem seed oil that you can actually spray in your garden. Mm. And the neem seed is actually very interesting. If you get an opportunity to do some research on neem, you might find this could be a really, I think, a good fit. Long-term standing, I know the United States government has done quite a bit of research on neem as an insect repellent. And it just has such a great broad spectrum action for, you know, bacteria, virus, fungus. You know, and I think, again, like just being aware when you are in a tick-borne area, you have to be highly vigilant.
And I've heard people will say, well, the tick has to be attached and possibly embedded for like 18 hours. Recently, I read it can be as short as 4 hours. Do you have an opinion on if once you find a tick, if it had to have been there for so long to likely transmit the disease?
I mean, there's probably with this disease like 100 myths. I don't know how anybody could know that. If you have a tick that has a high spirochetal load and it lands on a child in a highly vascularized area and has a blood meal, you know, without a doubt, you know, the spirochete is going to be going into their system. I mean, it's really hard to say. In my opinion, it's not worth the risk in going back and forth. Well, was it 24 hours? Was it 4 hours? How long was it? I actually treat it pretty aggressively. You know, I think it's important, you know, if you can, to save the tick. Some people are really funny about it. They get so angry about the ticks that they decide, you know, to mutilate it. And I don't know why they do that.
I have seen people do that.
They do.
Recently, my 8-year-old got bit by a tick, and we found it the next morning, and she had a, you know, redness around it. So we actually took the tick off, and we sent it to a lab in Vermont. That test was like $65, and we got the results back that it was not a Lyme infested tick, which was nice for our peace of mind.
Sure. So I, you know, and just because this is an opportunity to really educate, you know, there are different guidelines and different approaches. I spent quite a bit of time working with Dr. Charles Ray Jones, who's a pediatric Lyme specialist in New Haven, Connecticut, and he's a good friend of mine. And one of the things that I will tell you, he's treated, you know, he's in his 80s, he's treated over 15,000 chronic pediatric patients with Lyme disease, and he doesn't mess around. I follow his protocol and international protocol, which is to treat regardless. And so that may seem really aggressive to some people, but what I would argue would be there isn't a 100% guarantee that they're going to be able to capture the DNA. So it could be a false sense of security when you get, it's important to get the tick tested, in my opinion. You can't always get every tick tested.
That kind of the controversy in the medical industry, too, about how thoroughly they're testing people for Lyme's disease?
For sure. And I would say it's you know, when you get bit by a tick right then and there. So let's just go with the 24 hours for one moment here. If you get bit by a tick and you think that it's been about 24 hours, in my opinion, there's no reason to test right in that moment because your body might not have had an opportunity to really create a response. Now, one of the unique aspects about this bacteria is that it has certain components that enables it to shut off our immune system. So there's this antigenic variability that happens with the Lyme spirochete. And so, however, that being said, the immune system needs time. And so doing initial testing, at least from a serological standpoint for the individual, in my opinion, you should wait some time.
Okay, and so see what the body's, how it's going to
react. See what the body's going to do, but that doesn't mean necessarily to wait on treatment. Mm-hmm. So international guidelines are you treat for 21 to 30 days, you know, for tick bites. And what I would say would be, Dr. Jones' guidelines are you treat, if a tick is embedded, you treat for 30 days. I follow those guidelines in my clinical practice, and I can just say, you know, with my experience, I do not have a single person that was bit by a tick that acquired Lyme when I've done this treatment. And so I feel confident in backing it, although I'm a naturopathic doctor, so I don't love prescribing antibiotics, but in my opinion, this is an effective way of preventing the illness. And it is aggressive. It's very different than what conventional medicine states, but I think it's extremely effective, and I think I'd like to see more doctors doing it. Now, there's a lot of concern about, well, what about antibiotic resistance? And I venture to say, okay, well, we've got lots of other diseases where antibiotics are used. For example, I have many patients that have been on the tetracycline class of drug for 20 plus years because they had acne. Or I have multiple patients that have lupus or rheumatoid arthritis that have been on Plaquenil for 20 plus years. In my opinion, the benefit outweighs the risk. That's my personal opinion.
So what is your opinion on somebody that maybe had Lyme disease undiagnosed for several years? Do you think antibiotics are beneficial for them as well?
What's going on with the person? You have to really look at the person and what is going on with them. So is it, you know, and at that point, like say the person has, say we know for sure that they have Lyme disease for 20 years. What's their state of health? So that person could be somebody with like severely neurological illness, like say like an ALS, a Lou Gehrig's disease, mm-hmm. or that person could be somebody who's dealt with like a chronic fatigue. You really, in my opinion, in regards to long-term antibiotic therapy, you have to really see the patient and you have to really evaluate what is the vital force of this patient. Is this patient able to withstand that level of treatment? Right. And sometimes it's, you know, one of these things where you say, okay, I'm going to treat with antibiotics. I'm going to do this. Let's try it for a month. Let's see how much better you feel. If the person feels better, then maybe we'll continue another month. I try to look at things month by month. Okay, let's see how much progress we make or not. And let's alter our treatment based on what that progress is.
Good.
Or not.
Typically, if a tick is embedded, a bite happens, undiagnosed, untreated, commonly, we'll say in a child, how long is it before a symptom might manifest? Is it pretty soon? Is it months later?
It could be both. It could be a gradual onset. It could be an immediate onset, you know, within a few hours to 24 hours to 48 hours to 1 week. What I would say would be really looking at the bite. Oftentimes, people get concerned, and a lot of people think that they have a bullseye. There's oftentimes, if you've been bit by a tick, if anybody's been bit by a tick, which a lot of us have, there is a redness. There is like even a red circular, but it's small. It's not pronounced. It's not very large, and it doesn't necessarily look like a bullseye, despite the fact that it is circular. This is a common very common thing to see with any tick bite. What you're going to see with a bullseye, it's really looking more of like a bullseye. Like there are rings and it's, you know, very well circumscribed, you know.
It's like
and
a Target logo.
Yeah, it really is. It's really like a bullseye. And there can be variations within that. But when you see a bullseye, if you've ever seen a bullseye, it's very clearly a bullseye. So that is different than the little bites. But I can tell you with those little bites, they're sort of curious. I had a client recently who's a good friend of mine who came in and she was bit by a tick. And what I've seen a lot of is this like blackened necrotic center. So it's almost like the tissue gets really, really affected and necrotic. And I was very concerned in her case, even though she was very clear that she found the tick really quickly. Like she went out in the garden and it was in and then it was embedded. I felt really clear that we needed to treat her because of how that bite looked. It didn't look so good and there was some pustules coming out of it. And so even if there isn't a bullseye, I've had some interesting cases where the bite itself like cycles. So every 3 to 4 weeks when the person, so the Lyme can cycle within the body and the person can say, oh, well, every month, you know, during treatment, I just don't feel so great. You know, and it happens almost like clockwork, like every 3 to 4 weeks. And so, and what I've also witnessed in my clinical practice is that that same patient or another patient might say, and you want to know something? The bite hurts. Where the actual bite was. I had a clinical case that was in today where this man was bit by a tick and the whole side of his right hip and buttocks, it's so indurated and hard. Now, this organism has some really unique capability, and what it's able to do, I think, from a dermatological standpoint is extremely destructive. And so, you know, in thinking about the bite, and this is the beauty of, I would say, naturopathic medicine in that, you know, there are lots of other things that you can do besides, you know, just taking antibiotics to be preventing, you know, the Lyme disease. There are lots of things that you can do in the realm of homeopathy, and I would say even in like herbal type of oils that you can place on the bite to try to heal that tissue, because what I've found over and over and over again, even in these non-bullseye bites, that it's a problem and that people are actually carrying on with this dermatological issue as they go through their treatment, and it's part of the feature of their illness.
Wow. Okay, so a tick bite happens. What is the gold standard for testing to determine if it's actual Lyme? Maybe the other side of the question is, what testing do you feel is maybe common but not a really accurate testing?
Sure. So I'm always coming from the place that I want to know what the person's all about as far as their health's concerned. So, and why do I care about that? Because Lyme is a great mimicker, and if I think that there's a thyroid issue, I'm going to chase that because it's important to know, and it just... The next thing you know, somebody has something else that's going on that's pathological, and you know, you've just done a Western blot, and that doesn't really make a lot of sense to me. But initially, you know, what is done from the conventional standpoint, I'll start with that, which is a titer test. So they do what's called an IFA, which is a immunofluorescence assay. They're fluorescing, you know, the antibody fragments, and they're counting them. And so the titer at a certain level is positive. Now, part of the issue with that, now, when I see a positive titer, which is very infrequently, very, very, very infrequently, and it's never a standalone test that I do in my practice, when I see a positive titer, because a lot of the titer tests, there's like a 60 to 70% false negative with the titer test.
So meaning it comes back so this that you don't have it, but you do.
Yeah, and okay. This would be argued. Now, I will tell you in my clinical practice, I would say it's a much higher false negative. Now, I also get a lot of clients that have most likely had the disease longer. And so really what they say is that the titer is going to be elevated within the first couple weeks. Now, everybody's immune system is different. I occasionally will get, you know, a patient that, you know, I run a basic Lyme panel on them and I do a titer and a Western blot. And the Western blot's looking like maybe they have more of an IgG shift. And I'm really clear that this has been, you know, maybe say like a year long. And for whatever reason, they have a random titer that's high. That's really a rare case. That's not a common case in my clinical practice. Now, unfortunately, with the titer from the Center for Disease Control's model on Lyme, there's a two-tiered approach. You do a titer test. If that comes back negative, you don't move on to do a Western blot. Now, I can't say this enough. I just did this lecture out in Bellevue, Washington on Lyme disease. And I can't say enough, Lyme is a clinical diagnosis. And so all the tests will support the clinical diagnosis. But if you don't have a clinical diagnosis, as far as I'm concerned, the test really isn't, it's not as important as, you know, really understanding what's going on with the individual, because it can be, the person can have a negative, you know, serological test result, and yet they can still have Lyme. And we see this all the time, particularly with titer tests, but we can also see it with the Western blot. Now, as far as I'm concerned in regards to testing, the more testing, the better. And so, you know, with a disease where there's no gold standard for testing, you do as many tests as you possibly can. I can't tell you how many times I've had a patient that came to me and said, oh, well, my doctor did a titer test, but it came back negative, and they didn't do the Western blot, and they treated me for 2 weeks because they thought maybe it was Lyme disease. But, you know, after the treatment, you know, they said, you're finished, and then my symptoms persisted. So with a Western blot, it's going to give you more information, and it might not always, but it will for sure give, it's a, there's no reason not to run a Western blot as far as I'm concerned.
So basically what I'm, what I'm hearing is if you only get a titer test, it's a 60 to 70% chance at least that it'll come back that you're fine and you're maybe not. It's better to get that and a Western blot, but even with that, it's possible you could have contracted Lyme and the tests are not showing it.
I always do both. And so we can get into what I do thereafter if it comes back negative and I feel like I'm really confident that they have Lyme. And that's where I was saying before, like, you really need to look at what else is going on. So there's other markers, in my opinion, that really influence, you know, whether a person has Lyme or not.
Right. Do you ever use the CD57?
I do use CD57 often. I don't use it in children. Dr. Jones doesn't believe that with children this is an accurate test. Actually, the research on the CD57, which was done by LabCorp, there are no pediatric reference ranges. So I don't bother with that test with kids, but I use it extensively. But I'm not just talking about that.
Right.
I'm also talking about that, but I'm also talking about liver function, anti-nuclear antibodies, rheumatoid factor, you know, anti-cyclic citrullinated peptide. Like, I'm looking at a lot of other things that can really help me understand, okay, is there systemic inflammation? Lyme is about, you know, infection, immune dysfunction, and inflammation. Is there systemic inflammation? Right. Are we seeing liver activity involved? Is there something else, some other autoimmune aspect? Is, if the thyroid's, you know, off mark, you know, let's run some antibodies to see. Because what this organism is doing with the immune system, it's setting you up for something else. And so if there is that potential there at the very beginning, let's say even a genetic potential, let's say that I have a brilliant case of, you know, grandmother, mother, and two daughters that have had a history dating back who knows how long of hypothyroidism with a Hashimoto's. This is how they all manifest Lyme disease. And so it's one of these interesting things where, in really understanding the clinical case before, during, and after, will help you in your guidance as far as treatments is concerned and testing.
So I hope that we've at least given some hope and some information that will help people. And again, if you want to contact Dr. Miklas directly, please do. Her website is livingnaturalinc.com. Living Natural Inc. is in Nashua, New Hampshire. Her phone number is 603-594-0002. And Dr. Miklas, if someone's listening in a different part of the country and they're looking for a specialist in Lyme disease, what's the best way for them to find someone?
I'm so glad you asked. So people can actually contact ILADS, which is the International Lyme and Associated Disease Society. I think it's ILADS.org, but if you just Google ILADS, you should find it. Again, International Lyme and Associated Disease Society. The other organization that I would like to steer people towards is Turn the Corner Foundation. They were really involved with the movie Under Our Skin, and they're a great foundation for connecting doctors and patients, and that's across the country. So also the CalDA, the California Lyme California Association of Lyme Disease. I think it's CALDA. They're great. There's another organization called Lyme-Induced Autism, LIA. You can find them online. So there are multiple organizations. And I would say, you know, as far as labs are concerned, there's several labs that I think are reasonable. Stony Brook Hospital in New York is a great hospital that does some good tick-borne testing. Igenex is another one. Clongen Labs in Maryland. All of those labs are excellent labs to either send ticks to and or to, I think actually Stony Brook might even do tick testing for free. So, yeah.
This is great. In fact, what we've decided to do is continue this as a two-part series because there's so many more questions. So we're going to wrap up this first part. Maybe a good ending note, Dr. Michaelis, is if you could, either through a case study or through an actual list, I would love to hear your opinion of some common symptoms that people might have that are in fact attributed to Lyme disease that maybe they wouldn't recognize immediately.
Sure. So the I will share with you that a few years ago, there was a gentleman, I think it was at the San Francisco International Lyme and Associated Disease Society's annual conference, there was a gentleman that did a breakout session, and he listed like 20 different diseases and all their symptoms that corresponded, and Lyme disease was one of them, and everything was just cross-referenced. I mean, it was like the, you know, the different disease, different name of the disease, yet all the same symptoms. And so what I can tell you is that Lyme is not just a joint disease. It is not just a neurological disease. In my opinion, it could be any tissue. And so if what I tell other clinicians is if you have a clinical case in your practice that you're giving good medicine to, that you know you're dotting your I's and you're crossing your T's, and for whatever reason that person isn't getting better, and you don't do a history take about tick-borne illness, do the history taking about tick-borne illness. Because time and time again, I've had cases where there's just been, you know, a sudden onset of anxiety with maybe some chronic fatigue. Children, this is so unique. Like with kids, and thankfully with Dr. Jones, I learned so much in his clinical practice. You know, you start to hear some of the social things like, oh, the teacher may report or write a note back like, oh, the child's putting their head on the desk. And I don't want everybody to, you know, children can be tired and put their head on the desk, but I've noticed that the stamina isn't there. Maybe the child's taking naps. They're complaining about stomach aches. Maybe they have some sort of bowel dysfunction, or maybe all of a sudden there's a sudden onset of a headache that comes and goes, or they have a knee pain that seems like it's been going on for a few months and it's not really related to growing pains, you think. Or maybe it's in one knee and then it goes to another knee. Or maybe they complain, gosh, I really felt dizzy. Or their appetite decreases. Or they start losing weight. The list goes on and on and on. This is the one thing that I would say that I am continually amazed with this particular illness, that I really truly believe you have to come, as a clinician, you have to come from the place, what does Lyme mean for you, right? It's really about the individual. And this is why this illness needs individual treatment. It needs chiropractic care. It needs naturopathic care. It needs the whole system holistic viewpoint in order to really be able to evaluate and to treat the person as an individual and to understand what this disease means for them.
Thank you so much, Dr. Michaelis. This information is so needed in our community. I know people will really appreciate this. I'm looking forward to our second segment. For those of you listening, we've been speaking with Dr. Margaret Michaelis from Living Natural Inc. That's www.livingnaturalinc.com, and she's in Nashua, New Hampshire. She can be reached by phone at 603-594-0002.
And if you know anybody that has Lyme disease or is suspecting that, please share this link on Facebook, share it with your friends, email it.
Thank you so much, guys. Be well, everybody.
You've been listening to some raw talk about full potential living for the health of it. For more information, go to spinalcorrectivecenter.com or call Dr. Jennifer at 603-673-5600. That's spinalcorrectivecenter.com or call 603-673-5600.